You really need a system if you're gonna make it work. You kind of learn to trust your own handwriting. That becomes an important part of your life. You write yourself notes, and where you put your notes, that also becomes really important. You need like a jacket that's got like 6 pockets in it, particular pockets for particular things. You just kind of learn to know where things go and how the system works.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
First, information is gathered from external stimulus via nerve receptors. Second, electrical impulses jump between cell gaps, causing neurotransmitters to be released. Third, the information is carried via nerve cells in the form of electrical impulses. Next, neurotransmitters are released, allowing brain cells to temporarily connect to each other. When the electrical impulse reaches the brain, the information is sorted and stored.
Congratulations, you've just made a short-term memory.
But don't get too attached.
Hey everybody, before we start the show today, I wanted to jump back roughly 200 episodes, podcast 242, October 25th, 2013, the first installment in my series with Gino Denning on The Trivium. In this clip, we're discussing the 3 levels of consciousness. Number 1, stimulus response. Number 2, perceptual. Number 3, conceptual. It's something that I'm going to discuss a little bit further, and really something I'd like you to keep in mind during today's show. Here we go.
So to come to know the way living things interact with their surroundings, there's stimulus response. When we look at stimulus response, you can move the sun over a stationary rock laying on the earth, and the rock doesn't respond. But a plant, which is a photosynthetic plant, is green, will follow either its flowers or its leaves will follow the sun across, making its path across the sky during the day. So that is its animation.
But I wonder how this relates to people or groups of people. When we're talking about, you know, 3 increasingly complex levels of consciousness, the first being this primary level, this stimulus response, it seems like there's, whatever the stimuli is, there's a programmed response, or whether it's programmed by nature or by something artificial. And there's no memory, there's no lesson of that stimulus-response relationship. Is it unfair to say that many people, and people especially in groups, behave this way at this very primary level of consciousness?
Not at all unfair. We have this. And this is what's being given to us in school. And this is what control is all about, is giving you the stimulus and waiting for your response, or giving you an input. Let's go back to the computer, giving you an input and waiting for you to regurgitate an automatic or preconceived response, a memorized response. And that takes us to our second level. What we're missing, what we're not being given, is that intermediate stage of logic, of figuring it out for ourselves rather than taking the word of the authority. And we get used to it. We get lazy if we don't have this idea of validly and truthfully thinking for ourselves and learning on our own. But the next level up does include memory, and that really does, that's our perceptual level. And all animals have this idea of taking in information with their 5 senses and using that actively, sometimes proactively. There's a lot of animal life up to the reptilian and amphibious genuses that just have this stimulus response situation. They do everything intuitively. The mammal comes along, and now, particularly in rearing of their offspring, most of the reptiles and amphibians lay an egg and leave it, a fertilized egg, and that is the next generation of their species. The mammal comes along, and now memory is trying to be used, and I like the way you put that, to learn lessons. We, as mammals, want to learn lessons. And in order to start to teach, the mother now has emotions. She now has feelings or emotions for the child, so that that child has an extended childhood in which to learn basic models from the parent. And then as you get higher, so-called higher into the mammalian genus, this memory work and teach and learn become more and more obvious. And the motivation behind it all is this idea of emotion. That's what motivates us. So that's our step in motivation. And this is really where we spend most of our time as humans, in this perceptual level of taking in the perceptions from our surroundings. This is the beginning of our mental life. It's really looking out there, seeing what's around us, tasting what's around us, feeling what's around us, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where we live. We live in this, first of all, stimulus response. Then we bring in our emotions to motivate. Mm-hmm. And now we start, we have this need to communicate. And this is where the conceptual level, which in my youth, it was the understanding that humans were the only ones who had this conceptual level of thinking voluntarily. Your percepts are not voluntary. They're automatic, as is a stimulus response. Open your eyes and you see. A noise is made and you can't help but hear it. A pressure is felt on your body. These are all automatic. But these make an impression. A number of those make an impression which are held in memory. And you start to relate what that impression was within the context of what your activity or your relationship was at that point. Well, now you come up to the human level of the conceptual, where you take a number of those percepts, a number of those perceptual instances, and start to model them before they happen, or they haven't happened as such. But you can proactively, by choice, model this mentally, and then go test yourself in reality. Are you in harmony with what is? Are you in harmony with the physical universe around you? Are you in harmony with your own mental state? And this has been the development. So this idea of coming up to this conceptual level, which you are in charge of, you have the yay or nay say to use it or not. To use it effectively, you can reflect what nature has given you. This power of observation, the power of removing contradictions, and finally to use it effectively in the real world.
And it grows from there, because once you're able to form some concepts, you know, you can start putting together new concepts from the previously established concepts, and from there you can replicate that process again and again and again, and you're learning.
You're learning and doing.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today is May 26th, and sorry I had to take a little bit of a break from this series. I didn't have to. I kind of wanted to. I've had this other project that is really taking more of my attention than it should right now. I'm very excited about it, even though it's something I'm not really planning on releasing until probably July. I had my first guests in the new studio last Friday, Stephanie and Brian from Sex and Science Hour, and Brian also does Sovereign Tech. Those are shows you should check out. We reconvened after a long break. You might remember last month's Conspirathon, the Silver Screen Edition. Well, we're not done with that yet. We still have a marathon within a thon to take care of on the work of Stanley Kubrick. So we recorded the first part of that, audio and video, and I'm so excited to get this video presentation put together. I find myself working away at it in the last few days. As soon as I get up in the morning, I really want to just open Sony Vegas and work on this. It's a very stimulating project, but I don't want to forget about the memory series. So we're going to get back to that today. I'm also working on a side project, editing an audiobook. I've been doing more of that in my spare time. I find it's a great skill set that I've built up over years of screwing up on School Sucks podcast and having to fix it. So putting those skills to work as well. Also, I've added a considerable amount of bonus content to the AV Club recently. So if you have access, a couple of items you might want to check out. First, Salad Adventures. When it comes to eating healthy, the world is against you. Brett, Puke, Andrew, and Nick, those are the guys I do a lot of bonus content with, discuss grocery shopping, dining out, mindful eating, and nutrition. Before that, this one is not for everybody. But if you have a strong stomach, I suggest checking out the film reaction we did on the 2007 horror comedy film called Teeth. This show was suggested by Dale, formerly of Flaming Freedom. You know Dale, he's been on the show before, who greatly enjoys making people feel uncomfortable. Warning, extremely explicit, and that is no joke. I also added some behind-the-scenes audio and video of the Conspirathon Silver Screen Edition, about half an hour of content there. And by the way, you can see all this stuff just by clicking the AV tag on the front page of our website, schoolsocksproject.com. But if you want to go further back, I would recommend the State of the Free State Project. This is a discussion and a bit of a debate that I had with Mark Edge of Free Talk Live and Ellen Ball about this thing we all came to be involved in here in New Hampshire, the Free State Project. That was recorded back in March. So if you don't have access to that stuff, please consider going to schoolsocksproject.com/AV. You get so much more stuff in exchange for your monthly contribution. So even though things have been busy, it doesn't mean we let our lives get thrown out of balance, you know? It's beautiful outside. It's important for me to be able to spend some time with the people I care about, go out on my deck and do my kettlebell snatches, enjoy a mindful enjoyment of the stimuli. You know what I mean? We're trying to improve our memories here, and that's important. So I've been experimenting with rewilding, foraging. A few days ago, I went out and I gathered some dandelion greens. And some of you might be saying, wow, Brett, dandelion greens, how exotic. Listen, first of all, I'm new to this. And, you know, getting the best dandies is not a walk in the park, if you know what I'm saying. You can't collect them in the park anyway because people are bringing their dogs there to pee on things. It's not like you can just walk down the road and pick these things. They're all covered with brake dust and God knows what. You really got to get off the beaten path. There's no shortage of delicious things, probably in your area, but you want to be extra careful that you're not picking them out of patches of poison ivy. That's a pro tip. Pro tip. Remember when people used to say that? That was stupid. And what makes it kind of a trick? You're not looking for dandelions with that yellow flower already bloomed. You should ideally find them before that happens. And you also, you want to find the leaves that are not too toothy. You know, you can picture a dandelion leaf, how they have those little teeth. Ooh, remember Teeth, that movie? Yikes. That's not what you want. You want to find younger dandies that have smoother leaves. The more toothy the leaf, the more bitter the green. It is a bitter green, but what is your bitterness threshold? That's a question you should ask before you go foraging for dandelion greens. I also got some violets. I've got a guide, and I'll probably update you on that as I make more progress. Anyway, let's get on with today's show. Listen, you know, I think I'm going to call this one optional. I'm going to try to keep it as brief as possible. I wanted to do a quick sprint through the parts of our memory. And this is a setup for two or three discussions that are going to follow, concluding this series on strengthening the memory at each phase. And the first phase is registration, the actual learning phase. The second phase is retention, this proper storage of memories. And that leads to the third phase, which is recall, making the memory useful at the optimal time. And I also wanted to expand on that clip that I used at the beginning of the show back in 2013, my discussion with Gene Odenning, consciousness, Gene's definition, the mental faculty in living beings which grasps and or reacts to existence, or the faculty which is aware of its surroundings. And this is going to relate to encoding of new memories as well. So the primary level of consciousness is direct sense experience, involving essentially one stimulus and one usually pretty automatic response, a reflex with no attendant memory of the event. So this is basically what your sensory memory is. The second level is perception, which involves the addition of memory residing in a mentality, a nervous system, level one, plus a brain, level two. So any kind of stimuli that forms an automatic unit of cognition or impression, sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell. Gene used the phrase, the five instruments of knowledge. The third level is conceptual, which is forming an abstract idea collected and generalized from the memory of two or more perceptual instances. This includes our ability to identify universals. So the integration of percepts. And of course, there's a cumulative effect here because we get this power in the ability to form other concepts from previously established concepts.
Yeah, concepts are abstractions. They live in our mind. Mm-hmm. And the power of our mind, of the conceptual mind, the abstractive mind, is building, as you just mentioned, abstractions from other abstractions, new concepts from already devised concepts. And this is the power of the human. And it all starts with his putting together the grammar with which to bring understanding to this mass of data.
From here we get reason, the integration of our perceptions into concepts. And back in 2013, the method we used to describe this process was called the trivium. Through the intake of our five senses, we form these concepts, we create propositions from raw sensory data, and begin to form a body of knowledge. Then we subject what we've taken in so far to the rules of logic, aiming to eliminate contradictions and build an understanding. And finally, we test ourselves in the validity of what we've done so far through expression. And one of the best forms, as we discussed in that series, was the persuasion of another person to accept the conclusion we've reached based on the two prior steps. So keeping all that in mind, let's talk more about learning. Our memories are fundamentally associative. We can remember any new thing that we learn much better if we can associate it with previously acquired knowledge that is already somewhat cemented into our memories. The more meaningful the association is to us, the better our chances of remembering. Now, many people have this idea that the memory is this vast collection of information, this data archive. But most of our memories, as we talked about before when we went through our little tour of the brain, memories are not stored like whole files on the computer. Whenever we want to actually remember something, we basically have to go through a very rapid process of reconstruction from elements that are scattered throughout various areas of these brains. So no neurologist today is really thinking about the memory process as retrieval of fixed, complete records. They're thinking about it more as an ongoing process, continuous change in our neural pathways, and what's often referred to as parallel processing of information. I'm going to share this very quickly. This is from McGill.ca. I will link this site in the show notes. Plasticity in neural networks. Every time you learn something, neural circuits are altered in your brain. These circuits are composed of a number of neurons that communicate with one another through special junctions called synapses. When you learn something, it is actually these synapses whose efficiency increases, thus facilitating the passage of nerve impulses along a particular circuit. For example, when you are exposed to a new word, you have to make new connections among certain neurons in your brain to deal with it. Some neurons in your visual cortex to recognize the spelling, others in your auditory cortex to hear the pronunciation, and still others in the associative regions of the cortex to relate the word to your existing knowledge. To learn this new word, you repeat it to yourself several times, and this selects and strengthens the connections among these various circuits in your cortex. And it is this new, durable association among certain neurons that will form your memory of this word. The strength of the association may, of course, depend on several factors. To remember the word days or years later, you will have to successfully reactivate these same neural circuits. Obviously, this will be easier if, when you first learn the word, you built these circuits to last by repeating the word and thus sending the corresponding nerve impulses down them many times. In contrast, if you repeated the word only a few times, then the connections among new neurons would be weaker and the new circuit would be harder to reactivate. All of your memories of events, words, images, emotion, etc., thus correspond to the particular activity of certain networks of neurons in your brain that have strengthened connections with one another. So, when it comes to this map of how our memories work, most of the science is as recent as the 1960s. And the popular understanding at that time was to see the memory, as I mentioned before, a single system, and the duration of each memory inside it could just vary. But as the decade went on, the memory was essentially broken up into three distinct levels, a memory flow. And these are, again, sensory, working memory, and ultimately long-term memory. So when our brains encounter some kind of external stimuli that captures our attention, the events collide with the sensory memory, which can only retain information for usually about a second or less, sometimes a little more, and it can be broken into two parts. The first part is iconic, which is visual data, and the second part is echoic, which is auditory data, and auditory data can last a little bit longer. The sensory memory doesn't even really require any conscious attention. The storage, and this is one of the reasons why the capacity is so low, is basically automatic. And even though, by and large, when you consider the amount of stimulus in our environments, it might seem practically useless, but it is an essential interface between the human brain and reality outside of it. When this collision happens, this piece of data can move from the sensory memory to the working memory by paying attention to it. Now, the short-term memory has a larger capacity. The duration jumps from about a second with sensory memory to about a minute. In the late 1950s, a neurologist named George Miller did a number of experiments on what he called memory span. And this is where that magic number, or what's referred to as Miller's Law, the idea that the short-term memory can hold between 5 and 9, 7 plus or minus 2 pieces of information at any given time. Now, there's a great deal of variables involved with Miller's Law. From his experiments, he found that more words could be recalled if they were shorter, if they were more commonly used words, or if they were similar in sound, or if they all originated from a single category like sports or movies. His data also suggested that if, like, let's say someone was trying to memorize a list of words, they would usually do better with lists that were read aloud versus lists they read to themselves. So the working memory provides our brains a kind of scratch pad. Think about reading for the purpose of trying to learn something new. As we try to we read a sentence and we try to understand it, we need to hold the beginning of the sentence in our mind while we read the rest. This is a task that employs the short-term memory. If we want to transfer it to a more permanent type of knowledge, the central executive plays probably the most fundamental role in working memory. It controls two neural loops. One is for visual data. This is called the visuospatial sketchpad. And the other one is for language. This is called the phonological loop. And we are probably all familiar with this inner voice, or sometimes it's an out loud voice that repeats word sounds to keep them in mind. And these two scratch pads can essentially hold that data until that data is erased by the next job we give the working memory. So this part of memory is actually very frustrating, and it's actually a leftover. It's an important evolutionary design that we really don't need anymore. Like negativity, we always wind up noticing the bad things because humans used to have to notice the bad things in order to not get eaten by them. So if you think about a much different world where a human is struggling to survive, it's very, very important that the brain is paying attention to a relatively small number of noteworthy pieces of stimuli instead of a wide array of perceptual details, which I think even today we would understand would only interfere with our need to make important decisions quickly. Now, we talked about the prefrontal cortex and the central executive and its essential role in short-term memories. So let's map the central executive into three components. Originally, it was only those two that I mentioned, the phonological loop and the visual spatial sketchpad. In 1974, a British psychologist named Alan Baddeley proposed a third component of the central executive called the episodic buffer. He wrote that year a paper called The Episodic Buffer, A New Component of Working Memory? The synopsis, in 1974, Baddeley and Hitch, that is his colleague Graham Hitch, proposed a three-component model of working memory. Over the years, this has been successful in giving an integrated account, not only of data from normal adults, but also neuropsychological, developmental, and neuroimaging data. There are, however, a number of phenomena that are not readily captured by the original model. These are outlined here, and a fourth component to the model, the episodic buffer, is proposed. It comprises a limited capacity system that provides temporary storage of information held in a multimodal code, which is capable of binding information from the subsidiary systems and from long-term memory into a unitary episodic representation. Conscious awareness is assumed to be the principal mode of the retrieval from the buffer. This revised model differs from the old principally in focusing attention on the process of integrating information rather than on the isolation of the subsystems. In doing so, it provides a better basis for tackling the more complex aspects of executive control in working memory. And just a little more from the paper, Baddeley writes, "The buffer is episodic in the sense that it holds episodes whereby information is integrated across space and potentially extended across time. It is, though, assumed to play an important role in feeding information into and retrieving information from episodic long-term memory. The buffer is assumed to be limited in capacity because of the computational demand of providing simultaneous access to the necessarily wide range of different codes. The episodic buffer can be accessed by the central executive through the medium of conscious awareness. The executive can furthermore influence the content of the store by attending to a given source of information, whether perceptual, from other components of working memory, or from long-term memory. As such, the buffer provides not only a mechanism for modeling the environment, but also for creating new cognitive representations, which in turn might facilitate problem solving. So in short, we can think about the episodic buffer as a kind of coordinating force between the other components of the working memory, the visual spatial sketchpad, and the phonological loop. The coordination becomes an experience, and the experience can move into the long-term memory. Now, once an item enters the long-term memory, it can stay there indefinitely. But there are several factors that can lead to some of these memories being very, very difficult to retrieve. Things like how long it's been since you first stored that memory, the gaps between rehearsal of the memory, when was the last time you even had to recall it, how well did you originally integrate it with pre-existing knowledge, and what kind of other associations might there be? And when forgetting occurs in the short-term memory, what it essentially means, there's a new nerve impulse that has just ceased to be transmitted through a particular neural network. If it's not reactivated, it just stops flowing. No lasting connection or pathway was ever really made. But in the long-term memory, forgetting can still occur, or what seems like forgetting can still occur, even when there was a once strong synaptic connection. Because there is no rehearsal, because there is no need for recall, because there's no emotional trigger, attached to that event, the neural network just becomes weakened. Or there's the activation of a new network that's essentially superimposed over the older one. So the short-term memory forgetting means no connection was made, and long-term forgetting is, and sorry to be crude with my language, just the connection gets dusty and then eventually kind of breaks apart. So the long-term memory is broken into several components. The two primary components of long-term memory are explicit or declarative memories and implicit non-declarative memories. Most of the research, most of the studies have focused on explicit memory, essentially the active and conscious recollection and reusing of facts. So long-term memories can be explicit of that nature, and surely you've heard people on this podcast and others with very good explicit memories, very adept at thinking on their feet and recalling things and making them useful in conversations. The other side of that is implicit memory, things that are recalled automatically without any effort. So implicit breaks down again into procedural and emotional conditioning. Procedural memory is entirely automatic sensory motor behavior. And obviously, we've seen examples of people with amnesia who have no notable changes or degradations in procedural memories. It is a system of separate neural pathways entirely. The other side of implicit memory is conditioned emotional responses. I'm going to go back to McGill for this one. It brings up a couple of the areas of the brain that we covered in previous shows. The two pathways of fear. When the brain receives a sensory stimulus indicating a danger, it is routed first to the thalamus. From there, the information is sent out over two parallel pathways, the thalamo-amygdala pathway, the short route, and the thalamo-cortico-amygdala pathway, the long route. The short route conveys a fast, rough impression of the situation because it is a subcortical pathway in which no cognition is involved. This pathway activates the amygdala, which through its central nucleus generates emotional responses before any perceptual integration has even occurred and before the mind can form a complete representation of the stimulus. Subsequently, the information that has traveled the long route and been processed in the cortex reaches the amygdala and tells it whether or not the stimulus represents a real threat. To provide this assessment, various levels of cortical processing are required. First, the various modalities of the perceived object are processed by the primary sensory cortex. Then, the unimodal associative cortex provides the amygdala with a representation of the object. And an even higher level of analysis, the polymodal associative cortex, bear with me, everyone, conceptualizes the object, and also informs the amygdala about it. This elaborate representation of the object is then compared with the contents of explicit memory by means of the hippocampus, which also communicates closely with the amygdala. The hippocampus is the structure that supports the explicit memory required to learn about the dangerousness of an object or situation in the first place. The hippocampus is also especially sensitive to the encoding of the context associated with an adversive experience. It is because of the hippocampus that not only can a stimulus become a source of conditioned fear, but so can all the objects surrounding it and the situation or location in which it occurs. The imminent presence of a danger then performs the task of activating the amygdala, whose discharge patterns in turn activate the efferent structures responsible for physical manifestations of fear, such as increased heart rate, blood pressure, sweaty hands, dry mouth, and tense muscles. So even though separate, we see this parallel operation of our explicit, knowledge-based, hippocampal memories and implicit, amygdala-centered, emotional memories. And let's take that information back to our discussion of trauma. We've talked a lot, especially in the series that we did, Adverse Childhood or Experiences, about suppressed memories from experiences very, very early in life. But often, even though we have no conscious memory, we can't recall the details of those traumas. We can be triggered, again, I wish there's a better word, we can be triggered into an emotional and even a physical response by a piece of stimuli. So when we're very young, the hippocampus part of the brain is not fully formed, while the amygdala, a simpler, dumber part of the brain, but essential for our survival, is already ready to use out of the box, totally able to store unconscious memories. And so this is the science behind that incredibly frustrating situation. Even as adults, having these mental and behavioral functions driven by mechanisms and experiences to which we have no conscious access. So I thought that was a worthwhile tangent because it relates to so much of what we've talked about on the show before. So that's the implicit side of long-term memory. Procedural memories, skills, entirely subconscious, emotional conditioning, including things like emotional reflexes, also entirely subconscious. To jump back over to the other side of long-term memory, the explicit, the declarative, that breaks into two parts. Episodic, which is like biographical and events, and semantic, words, ideas, concepts. Episodic memory is what is most often affected by the various forms of amnesia. And I want to come back to that too, because I think it's an interesting subject. But episodic memory is also strongly influenced by the amount of emotion we experience at the original occurrence of the events. Now, semantic memory is the knowledge store. Some of it we can access fairly effortlessly, especially if it's information we use a lot. Some of it gets buried or seemingly replaced by other new pieces of data. Semantic memory also includes our store of rules or concepts that basically allow us to construct meaning of the world around us. Semantic memories are also usually spared in amnesia cases, but can be affected by other neurological challenges like dementia. So there you go. Simple review. We encounter some kind of stimuli. Information is gathered through the five senses via nerve receptors. This contact causes electrical impulses to jump between cell gaps in the brain, allowing neurotransmitters to be released. The release of the neurotransmitters at this point allow brain cells to temporarily connect to one another. Even though these connections are not permanent, they're not concrete, and they can change very rapidly and very frequently. But at this point, when those electrical impulses reach the brain, the information gets sorted and then stored. And at this point, we've made a short-term memory. So then through the process of rehearsal, the central executive, composed of a phonological loop, a visuospatial sketchpad, and an episodic buffer between the two, can direct attention at individual pieces of data for longer-term storage, the long-term memories. In most cases here, what we're talking about is explicit memory, either episodic or semantic. Episodic involves personal, autobiographical memories, while semantic deals with knowledge about the external world, words, ideas, and concepts. Long-term memories can also be implicit, either procedural or emotional. Procedural are the automatic references of how things are done. Emotional links perceptual information to an emotional response. Now, I opened the show today with a clip from one of my favorite movies of all time, certainly one of the best movies in the last 20 years, Christopher Nolan's Memento. The protagonist, or is he, is suffering from what is called anterograde amnesia. And I found this fun presentation on YouTube that I wanted to include just to wrap up the show today, discussing the accuracy of the depiction of anterograde amnesia in the film. And I'm hoping that this might help tie together and make concrete much of what we've talked about today, a powerful association. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope that was a helpful interlude. Join me again soon when we will talk about registration strategies.
So where are you? You're in some motel room. You just wake up and you're in a motel room. There's the key. It feels like maybe it's just the first time you've been there, but perhaps you've been there for a week, 3 months. It's kind of hard to say. I don't know. It's just an anonymous room.
So that was a clip from the film Memento, which chronicles the story of Leonard Shelby, an ex-insurance investigator who suffers from anterograde amnesia. People might assume that an amnesiac does not remember anything prior to sustaining an injury. However, that would be characterized as retrograde amnesia. Such is the opposite with anterograde amnesia, which is the more common of the two. Anterograde amnesia is distinguished by the loss of the ability to create new memories after the event that caused the amnesia, as well as the inability to remember the recent past, while long-term memories from before the event remain intact. Essentially, a person can no longer form new long-term episodic memories.
I can't make new memories. Everything just fades.
Episodic memory is the storage of past personal experiences that occurred at a particular time and place. They are autobiographical events, like your fifth birthday party, the time you broke your arm, or your high school graduation, as well as the contextual emotions that come with these events. Ranging from moderate to severe, a person may have difficulty forming new memories, or they may not be able to at all. Although it's commonly said that anterograde amnesia is when a person can no longer make new memories, this is not entirely true because you possess many different types. Long-term memory is everything you can remember that did not happen today and can be divided into three categories: episodic, procedural, and semantic. Episodic memories are the autobiographical events discussed earlier. Procedural memories are the steps for things you know how to do, like how to tie your shoes or ride a bike. And semantic memories are your knowledge of the world, including facts, definitions, and implicit understandings. All this is relevant because anterograde amnesia only impairs your formation of new episodic memories. So why is only the episodic memory affected? It all has to do with this little piece in the center of your brain called the hippocampus, which deals with converting short-term memory to long-term memory. Your brain is sort of a mirror image of itself, meaning you have part of your hippocampus on one side and part on the other side. Damage to only one side would mean your amnesia is not as bad. Procedural memory, or muscle memory, is created and stored in a different part of the brain called the cerebellum, which is why it is not impaired by the anterograde amnesia. If you know how to brew coffee or drive a car, this is the work of your cerebellum. These are things that can be done without having to really think about it. Anterograde amnesia most often occurs when there is damage to the hippocampus, usually as the result of a traumatic brain injury, in which the brain inside its skull casing is shaken up really hard. Punctures, infection by alcohol or other toxins, stress or surgery are other likely causes. Now, let's get back to Memento. Leonard spends the majority of the film frantically writing on scraps of pieces of paper as well as Polaroids, and once he has established something to be a fact, he has it tattooed onto his body. Here's a scene in which Leonard explains a bit of his process.
You really need a system if you're going to make it work. You kind of learn to trust your own handwriting. That becomes an important part of your life. You write yourself notes, and where you put your notes, that also becomes really important. You need like a jacket that's got like 6 pockets in it, particular pockets for particular things. You just kind of learn to know where things go and how the system works. And you have to be wary of other people writing stuff for you that is not going to make sense or is going to lead you astray. I mean, I don't know, I guess people try and take advantage of somebody with this condition. If you have a piece of information which is vital, writing on your body instead of on a piece of paper can be the answer. It's just a permanent way of keeping a note.
Memento is one of few films that portrays anterograde amnesia quite accurately. For example, Leonard remembers things for a few seconds up to a few minutes. This is common of those with anterograde amnesia, as they are unable to form new long-term memories. Also, he still has his procedural memory intact, seeing as he can still walk, eat, speak, drive, and do other things that are already learned. Similarly, Leonard can create new procedural memories through repetition, as also shown in the case of Henry Molaison, who could also form new procedural memories. Although unrelated to anterograde amnesia itself, Leonard knows for a fact that his memory is not a record, but an interpretation of his experiences. As with any Hollywood film, there are bound to be errors. However, in Memento, they are mostly minor. For example, Leonard actually remembers his injury. In real life, people with anterograde amnesia typically do not remember this. The most glaring error in the movie is Sammy Jenkins, a man with anterograde amnesia that Leonard investigated prior to his own injury. Sammy was repeatedly tested by doctors to see if he could form new long-term memories. He was asked to pick up 3 objects, with one of the 3 always being electrified. However, Sammy always picked up the electrified object repeatedly, even though it's shown that this was a result of his anterograde amnesia. He was still expected to eventually create the procedural memory of avoiding to pick up the electrical object, but he never did. So why is this? We know that procedural memories are not stored in the hippocampus like short-term memories are, before they're converted to the long-term. Finally, Leonard incorrectly addresses his anterograde amnesia as a short-term memory condition. Leonard keeps saying that he doesn't have amnesia because he still remembers his past and who he is. The writers possibly, 1, did this to avoid confusing viewers who are not informed of the differences between retrograde and anterograde amnesia, or 2, Leonard himself may not be aware or has forgotten that his condition is anterograde because he may think that amnesia is just forgetting the past. Hollywood movies are generally meant to entertain more than educate, and as a result, portray many medical and psychological conditions inaccurately for those who want to learn. However, the film Memento is known as one of few films that accurately portrays a condition like anterograde amnesia.
I have to believe in a world outside my own mind. I have to believe that my actions still have meaning, even if I can't remember them.